It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. An inaugural four-day ice climbing festival is set to open Thursday in Winona, Minnesota. It features a presentation by Wisconsin native Dave Roney, who started his adventures in ice climbing at Interstate Park on the scenic St. Croix River nearly a half century ago. As we explore ice climbing, call in with a question. You can add comments, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Dave, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I'm happy to be here.
So tell us about your origin story. You started climbing about 50 years ago. How did you first get into this?
Yes, the way I started was by reading about it, I guess. My dad was a voracious reader, and we always had books around the house. And one of the first I remember was called Annapurna, and it was a story about the first ascent of an 8,000-meter peak, which was Annapurna, and it's a remarkable story. It was back in the 1950s, captured my interest. And then he also had a series of books by Time and Life, and one was titled The Mountains, and it was just fascinating to me. So that was really the origins. And finally, we have a cabin on the, had a cabin on the St. Croix River, just below Interstate Park. So occasionally I would see people climbing there, and that's what really piqued my interest.
Ah, okay. And so then you find your way to Interstate Park. Where did you start, and what did you do in your climbing there?
Yes, initially I was rock climbing. Mm-hmm. I was just rock climbing for about a year, but of course I read everything I could about the sport, and occasionally I would read things about ice climbing. And, that was a part of climbing I wasn't familiar with and didn't know anything about, but I was interested. And remarkably, there is a dam in St. Croix Falls that goes across the St. Croix River, and that dam gets ice on the face in the winter. And my friend and I thought, hey, there's some ice. Let's go check it out. And so that dam face was the first ice I ever climbed in January of 1978.
Oh, wow. And you got bit by some bug, I understand. I mean, you eventually start really taking this seriously and devoting your time and energy to it. What makes a place good for ice climbing?
Yeah, great question. It was quite a while before ice climbing really became, I guess, my favorite part of climbing. Some of the reasons, ice is very different, of course. It changes daily. It changes with temperature. It is difficult to climb in that you can't just grab it and do anything with it. You have to have very specialized equipment. And so it's complicated. And then as you take it to higher levels, maybe into the mountains and other places, it just adds to the flavor of that experience. There's just so many things that you have to be prepared for, from avalanche hazard on approaches to ice falling off as you climb it, which is one of the biggest hazards. As you climb ice, you knock some of the ice off. And so, you have to be very careful and plan ahead.
We're talking with Wisconsin native Dave Roney, ahead of a new ice climbing festival in Winona, Minnesota. You can join in with questions and comments at 800-642-1234. So what is the most dangerous ice climb you've attempted, or the most one that you had to take a lot of precautions with?
Yeah, that's a good question. There've been a lot over the years, of course. I guess one that comes to mind is in the Canadian Rockies with another Wisconsin native, John Jugenheimer. We climbed a route just outside of Lake Louise in Alberta called Gimme Shelter. And Gimme Shelter had a lot of objective hazards. The ice climb itself was about 1,000 feet. It was a 13-mile ski in, and there was significant avalanche hazard getting to the base of the route. And then overhead hazard was the glacier at the top of the mountain, Mount Quadra, that the ice climb emanated from. In the summertime, there'd be melt, and then in the fall and winter, that melt would freeze. But with a glacier at the top of an ice climb, things called seracs fall off. Glaciers move, as you know, and they will move toward the edge of the top of a mountain and occasionally fall off. So there was a lot of objective hazard from avalanche to serac collapse.
You had to probably always stay on alert, always being aware of what was around you, the sounds, the sight. I would imagine you were using all your senses.
Exactly. Yes. And the key to one of the keys as well is to move fast and try to, one of the ways to eliminate hazard is not be there very long. So we watched conditions and we made the determination as best we could, and we were successful. It was we spent we, it took us a day to get in, and then we bivouacked, and then the next day we climbed and skied out. So it was quite an experience and one that I remember well to this day.
Do you have any like rituals or traditions when you reach the top or the peak of where you're trying to get to? Is there something you do?
No, I wouldn't say that. Enjoy the top, the satisfaction of reaching the top or finishing the route. But usually it is okay, let's go down. And, like I say, try to move fast and stay out of the hazard area as much as possible.
And so knowing when it is safe to climb, we had the Michigan Ice Fest canceled. Its outdoor programming due to unseasonably warm temperatures this month. Is finding suitable ice becoming more difficult?
Yeah, that's really unfortunate. For Michigan to have those kinds of problems, but the Midwest and other parts of the country certainly have had difficulty with ice climbing this winter. It's been so warm. And yes, finding appropriate ice can be difficult. It changes with temperature. And of course, warm temperature is bad, and ice will start to fall off of cliffs and other formations. So it adds to that hazard. And I would say that yes, it has become more difficult in the Midwest, especially this year,
So,
to
where do
find good ice.
climbers go to find suitable ice?
Well, that's another challenge. Cody, Wyoming is a very popular area. The Canadian Rockies by Banff and Canmore is an amazing area. Quebec, Colorado has quite a few areas. There's an online network that allows people to find out conditions and good places to go. So that's really helpful.
Dave Roney is with us, veteran ice climber from Wisconsin. Call in with a question. You can share your thoughts at 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. An inaugural ice climbing festival gets underway Thursday in Winona, Minnesota. And we meet Wisconsin native Dave Roney, who started his rock and ice climbing adventures in the late 70s at Interstate Park in St. Croix Falls. It's home to that steep walled gorge, the Dalles of the St. Croix River. Call in with a question. Share your thoughts. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Dave, ice climbers can participate in competitions around the world that are put on by the International Climbing and Mountaineering Federation. How do these ice climbing competitions work?
I'm not terribly familiar. It is usually a speed event, so climbers will all climb the same route. And they will not have an opportunity to preview it. So they have to start climbing this thing that they are totally unfamiliar with. And then it is mainly who gets to the top first or who gets the furthest on these routes. They are very difficult.
So speed keeps coming up here. Can you talk about the tools you use and the ice axes and how they work and how they help you keep going?
Yeah, so as I mentioned, you can't just grab ice and do anything with it. You've got to have equipment. And the two main pieces of equipment are crampons on your feet, which have very sharp points that you kick into the ice. And then you have ice tools in your hand, which are shortened axes, really, with very sharp picks. And the sharper, the better. It'll penetrate the ice cleanly and less likely to chip ice away. But ice tools and crampons are the primary tools for climbing ice.
And then you have like a rack of ice screws. What are they used for?
Correct. Ice screws are used to build anchors and or to protect yourself as you climb. They're hollow tubular screws, and they've got 3 to 4 teeth and very sharp again, and you just turn them into the ice. They come in various lengths depending on the thickness of the ice, but they are very strong and typically used in pairs for an anchor. When a climber leads ice, starts from the ground and goes up, they will place screws as they go.
Are they hard to get in with your own strength?
It can be challenging depending on the stance. If you have a nice flat stance on the ice, maybe a little ledge, it's easier to put it in because you can stand and press your body weight into it. If you're on a very steep section of ice and the footing is tricky, it can be very taxing and strenuous to put those in. But nevertheless, you've got to have them. They will protect you in case of a fall.
Is there art and technique to using these types of tools and these ice screws?
Absolutely. Climbing ice is all about decision making. You're making hundreds and hundreds of decisions as you climb on ice. You swing your tool into the ice and immediately, is that good? Can I pull up on that? Do I need to swing again? Is the ice here good for this screw? Is it going to be solid? If I fall, will the screw stay in place or will it pull out of this ice? So there's a lot of decision making that goes on with ice climbing, and I think that's what really makes it enjoyable.
How accessible is the sport of ice climbing? As you look at the tools and the gear, how accessible is it to athletes with disabilities?
It's improving, I guess I would say that. Climbing is pretty tough if you don't have full use of both hands and both feet. Nevertheless, there are remarkable advances have been made that do allow some people with disabilities to climb. I mean, I've heard of people having prosthetic legs fitted with crampons. So these kinds of technological improvements will help, but it would be extremely difficult, for someone like that.
Dave, is there like good training or simulation you can do for ice climbing in order to become comfortable with using these tools and the strategies?
I think the best training is these ice parks. And as you mentioned, Winona's going to have their first ice festival. Eric Bernard there has done such a fantastic job of bringing rock and ice climbing to the Winona and the surrounding communities. These ice parks are very safe. They have anchors at the top. The ice is monitored so that you know that it's going to be safe. There's instruction available, guide services. So that has really helped open up the sport to other people.
we're talking with veteran ice climber and Wisconsin native Dave Roney is with us ahead of an ice climbing festival. We are exploring this sport, adventure sport. You can join in questions and comments along the way, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Let's bring in Tim, who is in Winona, Minnesota. Tim, hi. Hi, Tim.
Hello,
can you hear
morning.
Us? Yes, good morning.
Yeah, I'm calling in from Winona, Minnesota, driving here to work this morning, and I can drive right past our awesome ice climbing park here. It's pretty cool.
So have you tried it?
No, I'm quite afraid of heights, but I know a lot of people that do, and it's just kind of unique. Just a beautiful scenery, too, just right along the highway, right on the side of the bluffs. Right next to Sugarloaf, which is kind of a nice, cool little local tourist spot here in Winona. But yeah, it's just a beautiful setting. And if I was braver, I'd love to try it.
Dave, what can you tell us about the setting for the ice park?
Yeah, as Tim mentions, it is really remarkable. It sits on Sugarloaf, which is above the city and right on the Mississippi. You drive to the top and have easy access. I have not climbed there before. I have seen it from below. I've talked to Eric. I've talked to a lot of my friends who've been there, and it's just an outstanding venue that Eric has put together.
So do you have to get a license in order to climb, or how does that work?
No, I wouldn't say that's the case. Usually these ice parks are open to anyone. If there is a problem, there would be signs or notices for people to stay away. But once the ice is formed, people are free to just show up and climb.
Tim, that means you. Show up and climb. Just do it.
All right, noted. Yeah, I was going to say last year when it was a little more ideal, I believe they had like free climb days. You could just go up and there was instructors up there. I don't know if that's been happening this year, but I thought that was kind of cool. And as you're driving down the highway, you can obviously see people up there climbing. So it's pretty interesting.
Well, I appreciate you calling in and giving that update on the way to work and giving us a bit of that view. So, Dave Roney, how is ice climbing then different from rock climbing?
Mainly the equipment. For rock climbing, a pair of shoes that have sticky rubber on them and a chalk bags to help improve your grip, keep your fingers dry. And then that's the difference. Those are really the only things you need to climb rock. But then, of course, to climb safely, you'll need a rope and some equipment for protection. But for ice climbing, again, it's the crampons and the ice tools. And then, of course, it's winter, so it's cold. And you have to plan for the clothing that you're going to wear and, just to make sure that you're comfortable. Is it going to be really cold? Is it going to be 5 below 0 when you're out ice climbing? Or is it going to be 15 or 20 degrees? That'll make a difference in your clothing selection.
I would imagine, too, your toes would get very cold there, next to the ice and going into the ice when in those really frigid conditions. Is that an issue?
Absolutely right. It hurts oftentimes because you are cold. Your toes get cold, your fingers get cold, and sometimes they just get numb with cold. Then you've got to stop and get the blood back in, and it's painful. It hurts at times, and there's a kind of a saying about the three necessary attributes of an ice climber. First is a high tolerance for pain. Secondly is a short memory. And I can't remember the third.
I mean, what pushes you through in those most difficult climbs? What goes on in your head?
Yeah, it's the challenge. Part of it, too, is being with your partner and working together to get through those things. As Tim mentioned, there's some fear and some anxiety. It's just overcoming those things. and planning and just working toward that objective of getting to the top.
Do you climb year round?
I do, yeah. So it's my favorite season has become winter for probably the last 15 years. But when the ice is gone, I rock climb as well.
And very quickly here, your favorite places to rock climb? Any tips you can throw our way?
Well, I live in Custer, South Dakota, which is 2 hours from Devil's Tower, and it is Custer also is right near the Needles. Beautiful rock climbing here in the Black Hills of South Dakota.
Well, Dave, good to talk with you. Thank you so much for joining us.
Well, I thank you for the opportunity, and I'm hopeful that some of your listeners will show up in Winona, and I'll see them next weekend.
All right. Dave Roney is a Wisconsin native with nearly 5 decades of experience as an ice climber. I'm Kate Archer Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. We check in with Wisconsin's congressional delegation. Democratic Congressman Mark Pocan joins us to discuss the latest issues on Capitol Hill. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Brad Kohlberg with a story about a delivery driver, an icy driveway, and a comedy of errors.
There's an old saying about the Postal Service: neither snow nor rain nor heat nor gloom of night, etc., etc. But if you're a driver delivering a package in the winter to the Lake Halley home of writer Patty C., well, good luck with that.
In Lake Halley, last Valentine's Day, it was a balmy 41 degrees and rainy. When I left for work, I was hopeful the many layers of packed snow on my steep quarter-mile driveway would melt. Instead, it became a bobsled run. Then an Amazon van and its rescue tow both got stuck. When I arrive home, I park at the top of the driveway and start my truck down towards the idling flatbed tow truck. I watch the driver wrap a long strap, looks like a slack fire hose, around a tree. Flatbed man says, "I can't get any traction, so I'm winching myself up. Then we'll get a smaller truck down here for the Amazon van." Amazon guy gets out of his vehicle when he sees me. "I am so sorry this happened," I say as a greeting. The same thing I just told flatbed man. Our driveway is legendary among delivery drivers. This one tells me he saw our package drop-off tote at the top of the driveway, but he says, "When I braked, I slid past it and couldn't back up." "How long have you been here?" I ask. "Just a few hours. I'm getting paid to wait." After my husband Bruce and I eat a quick dinner, I put together a care package for Amazon guy. Bottle of water, ginger ale, sleeve of Ritz crackers, Kind bars, banana. "Really?" Bruce says as he watches me rifle through our pantry. This from someone who once coaxed a lost delivery driver into the house when his car spun out halfway up our driveway. Bruce often calls our isolated driveway Donner Pass, the California mountain feature named after the family who perished trying to cross the Sierra Nevadas winter of 1846. Unlike for those doomed travelers, there will be no cannibalism in this vegetarian's yard. Bruce served that Domino's driver a sandwich and chatted with him at our kitchen counter until the kid's dad arrived with a pickup and a tow rope. Amazon guy accepts my snack through his open window. The passenger seat is filled nearly to the roof with envelopes and boxes, which means some disappointed sweethearts on this Valentine's night. He reports a new plan. Once flatbed man is out of the way, dispatch will send a four-wheel drive vehicle for the packages and Amazon guy. Nobody knows the slow going of a flatbed tow truck being winched uphill from tree to tree except the guy connecting the strap to the next trunk in an icy rain and getting pulled a measly 36 inches at a time up a driveway over 600 feet long. After waiting here 4 hours, the last two spent watching a rescue vehicle, Amazon guy exits his van with a headlamp strapped to his forehead. He tells me he's walking up the driveway and someone will pick him up. I can't even offer to drive him since the flatbed is still in the way. Any customers who track their packages will see them stalled next to Lake Hallie until morning. It'll be at least another hour until Flatbed Man makes it to the top. Amazon guy is wearing better gear than anyone in the Donner Party. Their wagon train got stuck in snowy, rugged terrain. Eventually, they ate their oxen hide snowshoes. When Amazon guy lifts 1 foot to show me his ice cleats, he falls into the snowbank. How many times can I apologize? How about one more?
Patty C. is a writer from Lake Hallie, Wisconsin. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org, on Facebook, and on Instagram. I'm Brad Colbert.
It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Amid a partisan clash on Capitol Hill over how to fund the government, deal with the border crisis, and military aid in the world, we hear from Democratic Congressman Mark Pocan of Wisconsin, and you have a line. Call in with a question, share comments, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Mark Pocan represents the state's 2nd Congressional District, including Madison, Reedsburg, and Dodgeville. Representative Pocan, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thanks for having me, Kate. Appreciate it.
Let's start with the impeachment of the Republican-controlled House impeaching Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas. The vote marked the first time a cabinet member has been impeached in over a century. You voted against it. Why?
Well, there was no reason to vote for it. That's why we haven't impeached a cabinet secretary in so long. It should be for wrongdoing, and there's nothing that's, you know, been done specifically wrong by this secretary. People just don't agree with policies, and bluntly, they wanted to make it a political issue. This is going nowhere in the Senate. This is what the House does these days. We can't pass a budget, but we censure members and we try to impeach people because that's all they're capable of. The Republican majority can't put bills on the floor that we actually have to pass. That's why we only passed 27 bills the entire last session. It's a pretty dark period right now in the House of Representatives.
So the Associated Press reporting that Majority Whip Representative Steve Scalise says impeachment sends a message for Mayorkas to do his job. What is your reaction to that?
Yeah, this is a campaign message. I mean, you know, there was a bipartisan agreement moving through the Senate to deal with the border. And Donald Trump said, no, because I need this for an issue in November. And every Republican rolled over and had their belly rubbed over this idea. So when we have an opportunity to do something, because Congress is the one who actually has to act, we have to change the laws. It's things the president can't do unilaterally. We are choosing not to now, even though there was a bipartisan group working on this in the Senate. So, you know, all of this is a bunch of ways to try to say there's a problem, but God forbid we would ever try to solve that problem.
So House Speaker Mike Johnson calling this bipartisan border security bill circling the Senate dead on arrival should it reach the House. What are your thoughts there? Does the country need tighter border security?
Yeah, I mean, the bill is absolutely dead on arrival because there's no way to revive it at this point. So it is done. So just like the first 2 years of the Trump presidency when he had a Republican House and Senate and they did nothing about the border, we're doing nothing about the border again. And to be fair, Congresses for the last two decades, Democratic and Republican, have not addressed this issue, sometimes for rules of the Senate and all the rest. But we do need to do things at the border, including extra protections, including a pathway to citizenship for aspiring Americans. When I first got to Congress in 2013, there was a bipartisan bill that went through the Senate with 68 votes, which is kind of unheard of these days. That would be a really great basis to start over from. But it is up to Congress to deal with this because we have to pass the actual statutes, the laws. And right now it looks like we're giving up for the session on this.
What does the House want in an alternative proposal?
Well, that's the thing, is they don't really want an alternative proposal. They want to make sure that we can complain about this till November and then somehow say it's Joe Biden's fault. I think the American people are smarter because they do realize it's Congress's fault. We haven't dealt with this. We just had an opportunity. We turned it down. And, you know, it's a lot of electioneering and very little action.
And in the same week, the Senate, you know, clears a $95 billion military aid package for Ukraine, Taiwan, and Israel. What is your position on this package?
Well, we think that it should be able to come up in the House. And I think there's some conversations about, can we try to do it in a way that maybe breaks it up so that people could have a vote on individual items? I mean, for example, I think, you know, Ukraine, I would guess, would have over 300 votes in the House, virtually every Democrat, and probably close to a majority of Republicans. Israel probably would have a lot of votes like that as well, although there are some of us, myself included, that think there should be some conditions on that aid, given how money has been spent on weaponry that's killed people in Gaza. And then, I think the humanitarian aid actually could be tougher. There's a number of Republicans who don't believe in humanitarian aid, yet that $10 billion is going to help rebuild places like Ukraine and Gaza. So I think that's the question. Is there a way to make it still be have a life in the House, perhaps by breaking it up? And then it might be individual votes. But it is ironic that the one thing that didn't survive because of the Republicans was the funding for security at the border. That is not in the bill because they would not allow even that piece of it to move forward.
Let's bring on a call now, Nate in Milwaukee. Nate, hi, go ahead.
Hi, thank you for having me. I think that we probably ought to thank Mitch McConnell for getting the aid to Ukraine through the Senate like he did in what is actually a bipartisan fashion. If we complain about all the partisanship, I'd point out that Ukraine has been winning most of the struggles of this war, where most Ukrainian offensives are successes, most Russian offensives are failures. But the only thing protecting Ukrainian cities and towns is the Ukrainian military, and they're running low on ammo, and Russia is basically trying to get certain people in the U.S. government to hand them a victory that they would not otherwise be able to get. And to save Ukrainian lives, we've actually got to get the ammo to them. And is there perhaps a way to go around the speaker, who seems dead set on actually helping people who I think deserve the help?
Nate, thanks for the call. Wondering, is there any maneuvering that could bypass Speaker Mike Johnson and force consideration of the bill on the House floor?
Yeah, Nate, there's really only one way to do that. That's the power of being in the majority party. You decide what's hitting the floor. They've kind of shot themselves in both feet over some rules they put in place that make it harder to do that. That's why we've been so ineffective in getting anything through the House. But there is a process called a discharge petition. If 218 members of Congress, which is a majority of the body, sign a discharge petition, you can force a vote. The difficulty is it's often considered a procedural vote by political leadership. So even if a Republican supports funding for Ukraine, it's very much frowned upon by their leadership, and that would probably mean Donald Trump if they would sign that discharge petition. So I think the goal will be, if that is the only way to move forward, I think virtually, well, I shouldn't say it. I think a lot of Democrats would sign it. Depends if there's ability to break the votes up a little bit. The question is, can they get maybe 30 Republicans to do that? I think that's the very discussion we're in right now.
How much pressure is time here? I mean, Nate brought up it is critical as you know, troops run out of supplies, out of weaponry. Meanwhile, you know, House is in recess until what, the 28th. Is that it?
Yeah, I mean, this is normal though. President's Week. I don't think I've ever been in. We are allowed to occasionally get back to our districts because it's good to connect with your districts. In fact, I would argue one of the things that helps us get things done in Washington more than anything is when we do get back home, and our constituents say, get to work, right? I think that often helps to kind of charge us a little bit. Part of why we're back on the 28th of February is we also have the funding deadlines of government on March 1 and March 8. So we've got that to do as well. I think the real issue here is just if Republican leadership is refusing to put this on the floor, the discharge petition process takes about a month. I mean, there's nothing you could do. If we were in next week, we could be there every day for a photo op, but it wouldn't change the timeline that it takes to do a discharge petition. It has started. So the clock is working to our advantage. The real question is why the House Republican leadership is so adamantly against funding a country, a sovereign nation that was invaded by Russia. And I think that's a question for the ages.
We discussed developments on Capitol Hill with Mark Pocan, Democratic representative from Wisconsin's 2nd Congressional District. Call in to field a question, share comments at any point, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. As Congress faces critical issues, we check in with Democratic Congressman Mark Pocan of Wisconsin. Call in with a question. You can share your thoughts at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Mike in Watertown is here. Mike, go ahead.
Hey, good morning. Thank you for taking my call. As our nation once again suffers and Americans are terrorized by public shootings, Congressman, what I would like from you is 50 words stating the Democratic policy towards gun safety laws, and none of those 50 words can include ban or background checks that have been a failed policy for 30 years now. If you don't have the 50 words, the nation has, or the station has, my number.
Mike, thank you for the call and addressing gun safety, Congressman. Such a top priority here as we see the losses in Kansas City.
Yeah, and, you know, I think what Mike is trying to do, unfortunately, is oversimplifying it. You know, people who talk through Twitter or think you can say things in 50 words that we obviously haven't solved as a country is part of the problem. You know, we do have a problem with gun violence in this country. Quite simply, there are very popular solutions that are out there, like background checks, including for people who don't buy from gun shops. Those folks already have a background check. So that's something you can do. I think some of us would ban assault weapons, which certainly would help since most of the mass killings are happening from that. But there can be an intelligent debate that should happen. The problem is the NRA, as a special interest, has so much influence in Washington and, quite honestly, in Madison, that it's hard to get to that, I think, common sense place we need to. And, you know, all we ever have are moments of silence on the floor of Congress, not moments of action. And that's a real problem.
Let's turn to budget now. One prediction market giving roughly 15% chance that the government shuts down in early March. Can Congress prevent a looming partial government March shutdown?
You know, the House Republicans kind of shot themselves, I said, in both feet by early last year. They changed the rules. And for anything to come to the floor of Congress, it has to have the votes from the Republicans first. They can't come and get Democratic votes. It's stupid, but it's the rules they put in place. And that's why we're unable to do anything. So even when it comes to the budget, they have to ideally have their votes. That's not going to happen because they have enough members and you only need less than a handful now to disagree that it won't work. So at some point, they'll have to come and get our votes, probably for a continuing resolution, because they have not obviously solved the problem. And then they'll likely, or very likely could be, another vote to vacate the chair because of, again, how the Republicans operate. I can't speak for anything that they've done other than if I had to bet, if I were sitting at a Vegas counter right now and they actually had a bet as ridiculous as whether or not Congress can get something done, I would bet we'll have a continuing resolution yet again, because we have not resolved the difference between the House and the Senate on the budget to actually be able to vote on a final bill.
So if Congress continues to fund the government through continuing resolution, is there enough money to be able to do the policy changes that Republicans are seeking for security on the southern border?
Well, and see, that's the irony, right? With a continuing resolution, you're funding everything the same. So you fund bad ideas the same level. You fund good ideas the reduced level, that whatever they're currently at. And you certainly don't do new policy because you're just continuing, you're treading water. So that's why it's not an ideal solution at all. But in a Congress that, you know, can't operate because of the rules that they're living by, the House Republican majority, that may be the best scenario you can get.
Are there policy provisions within these spending bills that you are either very much for or against?
Oh, a million of them. I serve on the Appropriations Committee. Mm-hmm. I would love us to do our jobs, right? I mean, I think we've all seen the Saturday morning cartoon of how a bill becomes a law. It would be so nice if that happened again. There are 12 appropriation bills we should be passing. But this year, Republicans, for example, on the agricultural appropriations bill, cut funding 41%. I mean, obviously, that's a ridiculous amount. It's not even manageable. But that's the kind of games that they played. And that's why we still don't have a budget. So it's very frustrating because this is the one thing that I do. I think the one bill that's supposed to pass when you can have fights over everything else is a budget. But now, we can't even get the House budget done.
Talking with Democratic Congressman Mark Pocan of Wisconsin, your thoughts and questions along the way, 800-642-1234. Sean in Oshkosh is here. Sean, hi.
Yes, hello. Thank you for getting me in. My statement is very simple. We have had multiple decades which do nothing except exemplify the failure of representational democracy. It is time for us as Americans to enforce and choose our right to have direct democracy. I do not see any other solution to partisanship.
Sean, thanks for the call. Congressman, what is your solution to this gridlock?
Yeah, I mean, the solution to the gridlock, bluntly, in my opinion, is when Donald Trump's out of the picture. I think things will get more normal again. There is no other figure in the Republican Party that's as strong. You know, it's really almost become cult-like with Donald Trump. And there are many reasonable Republicans that I've worked with over 30 years of being in local, state, and federal government that I can work with again. But right now, they're silenced by the way Trump operates. If they speak out different than him, they get primaried or they have to not run for reelection. And I think once we can get to into a place where Donald Trump, whose fame is from Celebrity Apprentice, is not the largest political figure in a major political party, I think we'll be much better off.
Very quickly, in our last few moments together, what is your priority during this House recess?
I think in general, I mean, what I'm most concerned with is this government shutdown looming on March 1st and March 8th. We're probably going to have to do a continuing resolution again. But we need to do that, not play the games and not bring us to the brink. Every time we do this, we hurt our nation's full faith and credit. So, honestly, just I wish we could have a more honest conversation about what we need to do as a Congress rather than what we've been doing. And that would have a significant impact.
Representative Pocan, thank you for joining us.
Sure. Thank you.
Mark Pocan, Democratic representative from Wisconsin's 2nd Congressional District. Morning show on the Ideas Network. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The black press, through history, has been a source of protest against racial inequities and a way to spread vital news for and about the black community. We talk about this legacy and the future of black media outlets in Wisconsin. Call in with a question. You can share comments. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Thomas Mitchell Jr. is editor of the Milwaukee Community Journal. That's a black newspaper serving the Milwaukee area. Thomas, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Yes, and Michelle Bryant is host of Say Something Real, a talk show on politics and current affairs airing on Milwaukee's WNOV. That's a Black-owned radio station. Michelle, welcome.
Good morning, Kate. How are you this morning?
I'm doing well. And rounding us out is Cheryl Thompson-Morton, who is director of the Black Media Initiative at the Craig Newmark Graduate School of Journalism at City University of New York. Cheryl, welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Cheryl, let's start with you. As you study and work with Black news organizations all over the country, how important are these media outlets to their communities?
Yeah, I mean, very, very important, both historically and in the present context. So I always like to say one of the projects that we have is a mapping project. And Black media is overwhelmingly local media, and local media serves very important functions in society, helping us understand the things that are most pressing in our lives day to day, stuff with the mayor and politics, stuff with, you know, water access. I mean, there are so many things that local media helps us to understand, and Black media has a really unique role and helping to make sure that the Black community is informed and also that power is held to account in regards to racial equity. In 2021, we published a research study, Why Black Media Matters Now, which is a comparative analysis between Black and mainstream media from March of 2020 through May of 2021. To really see, you know, we know historically Black media has been really important calling for equity across different sectors, specifically in abolition and also in the civil rights movement. But we wanted to see what is the role today in a more racially just society. And we saw that even today, Black media talks more about racial disparities than mainstream media and talks more about issues of importance to African Americans. We saw that Black media uses more humanizing language in their coverage, not just of Black folks, but of people in general. And we saw that Black media does a really great job in a unique way of covering today's events within historical context. And so that role and that connective tissue that Black media provides is really critical. And it's just as critical today as it was, you know, over, you know, nearly 200 years ago when the Black press began.
Yeah, thank you so much for that, you know, overarching look. But when you said using more humanizing language, can you give an example?
Absolutely, I have several. When we saw Black media talk about COVID-19, in their top 100 words, the words care came up, which did not come up in mainstream media. When we saw Black media talk about victims of police brutality, we saw the words son and mother come up in the top 100 words. We didn't see that happen in mainstream media. When we saw Black media talking about Africa, for example, we saw them bring up women, mothers, and those terms didn't come up in mainstream media. And so we saw in general, the terms that were coming up among the top 100 words across topics focused on people. We saw, especially with police brutality cases, Black media mentioned the names of family members, specifically mothers, and mainstream media often did not. And so in general, what this showed us was that Black media was attempting in all of these cases of different topics to take it from a policy issue or, you know, something that's happening over there to something that's happening to a family member.
Much more personal.
A neighbor.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Michelle, I wonder, as you listen to this, you know, leading a talk show, Say Something Real, what do you think about with language and connecting with your listeners?
You know, I couldn't agree more with what was just said. As I deliver show content every day, I am very mindful of the need to be respectful when you talk about certain topics, no matter how devastating they might be to the community. I am mindful to figure out a way to uplift as I provide information, to realize the impact that it has on listeners. So I couldn't agree more that I am very deliberate in the way I give a story, in the way I cover issues, and in the way I talk to the community, because so often members of our community, they see themselves represented in the worst possible way, frequently in mainstream media. And so, you know, I realize that when we are engaging people, and I try to do it in a way that, and it's so funny that you pulled that out, Kate, in her remarks, in Cheryl's remarks, because I wrote it down when she said it, humanizing language. So I couldn't agree more.
We're talking about the history and future of Black media, and we have Cheryl Thompson Morton at the Black Media Initiative. Michelle Bryant is here at WNOV in Milwaukee, and we're going to turn now to Thomas Mitchell Jr. at the Milwaukee Community Journal. Thomas, how is your publication different from, say, the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel or other newspapers in Wisconsin?
We're different from the aspect that we... Well, as Michelle and Cheryl said, we focus on the community, and we really try to emphasize the positive aspects within the Black community. I agree with what Cheryl said about using humanizing language, more something that's more personal. When I do interviews, I try to be respectful of individuals and the things that they're going through, and try to pull out of them information that normally would be, that wouldn't be asked by a reporter, say, from the mainstream. Also, we try to emphasize on the front page of our paper a lot of photos. Photos pretty much dominate our front page, and they're photos of events that have happened in the community. I try to use multiple photos for events. Like one particular event, I'll use a large photo, then a couple of smaller photos, and then a longer than usual caption explaining what the photos are about. So basically, I'm trying to show the positive aspects of Black Milwaukee that you don't see with the mainstream press.
Why do you think positive news gets overlooked by other media outlets or ignored?
Because it doesn't have the sell factor. It's not sexy enough to them. The old saying, if it bleeds, it leads. So basically, if it's something crisis going on in the Black community, they'll put it on the front page and just do a clinical analysis of what's happening in the community, but they don't delve into the personal aspect, the human aspect, which is what we do. And that's what we don't do. For instance, we don't do crime stories. We don't give a running tally of who shot who, where, when, and why. We deal with the aspects of Black life that might lead to violence, that might lead to stealing cars, that type of thing. So we try to keep it positive, but at the same time, inform people about what's going on in government, what's going on in the schools, and try to keep them aware of those things that they need to be aware of in order to make change.
Thomas Mitchell Jr. is editor of the Milwaukee Community Journal. We have Cheryl Thompson Morton with us, directs the Black Media Initiative at City University of New York. And Michelle Bryant is here, host of a morning talk show on a Black-owned Milwaukee radio station. Call in with a question. Share your perspective. 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The archives of Black-owned newspapers and radio programs, they allow us to get closer to civil rights history and racial injustices through time. And we discuss this legacy and then how the Black press operates in Wisconsin today. Be part of the discussion at any point. Call in with a question, share thoughts, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. We have Thomas Mitchell Jr., editor of the Milwaukee Community Journal, with us. Cheryl Thompson Morton leads the Black Media Initiative at City University of New York. And Michelle Bryant hosts a show called Say Something Real on a Black-owned Milwaukee radio station. Michelle, you know, what issues are you exploring on your show, and how do you choose the stories you want to talk about with listeners?
So because my background is politics and social work, I actually am a chief of staff for a Wisconsin Senate office and have been for a number of years. Politics is one of the reasons I actually got into talk radio, because I felt it was important to explain many of the legislative priorities that I had seen being pushed and ushered through the legislature that were impacting Black voters. And in many cases, legislators, in my opinion, weren't doing a good enough job of coming back to the district and explaining to people what was happening. So that was my wedge in. But I also deal a lot with educational information, you know, reminding our community of just many of the great accomplishments that we've achieved. And one of the things that I'm also known for is information. You can get information on everything from the latest, you know, book to job opportunities, research that's out there that impacts us in some way. So I really go about doing my best to educate my listeners as I, you know, inform and give information. And then every now and then, you know, I'm good for a joke. My laugh, my laugh is outrageous. And I've actually had a number of listeners comment on the fact that they wait for me to start laughing. There's something about it that's infectious. And I believe that laughter is good for the soul. So I will definitely work in a way to have some ridiculous moments on my show as well.
I was listening to some of it and noticed just how often you like say, like, get your pens and pencils ready. I've got information here. And, you know, I thought about how important that is to conveying information to the community. And, you know, to, as you say, take this down, take notes here. Why do you say that?
Well, first of all, because what I have found is that people will always say, I missed it, you know, because everybody in the city of Milwaukee has my cell phone number. And so people will text me, repeat it, Michelle, I wasn't ready. And so, you know, they've trained me to say, get your pen and pencils ready. But I also know that, and, you know, and as people are driving and it's hard to kind of, you know, keep up with everything that you're hearing, but when there is a point that I'm really trying to drive home, something that I know will benefit them, benefit their children, opportunities, we talk about, you know, we were so excited with the Promise program at MATC and the ability for people to go to college and not have to worry about, in terms of the associate degree, not have to worry about those costs, student loan debt relief and what they could do to get back on track if they had student loans that were, you know, delinquent. Like, no, you need to listen, because I know these are things that are impacting members of our community. So I would raise that as just a flag to say, okay, I'm getting ready to say something really critical. And I know it's something that if you can't use it, you know others who can. So pay attention. So it's just an extra way to get people to understand this is something you want to really hone in on and give your attention to.
Cheryl, what role do you think does Black media have in the continuing struggle for equality and for the struggle to convey information to people who really need it in their daily lives?
I mean, it plays a really, really important role. I mean, I think part of what was being said about, you know, bringing joy into the conversation, I think I've heard that throughout the comments today, you know, not just focusing on the challenges, but having an asset framing is a really important point of why folks listen and read these publications and these radio shows and stations. Black media really calls out and holds power to account specifically around racial equity and racial inequality. It's been doing that since the Freedom's Journal, which was founded in 1827. And we saw in our research, and we've seen historically, Black media talks more about things that are specifically impacting Americans than anyone else. Mm-hmm. When it came to the racial disparities with COVID-19, for example, we saw Black media talk about that like at double the rate of mainstream media.
Wow.
When it came to talking about Breonna Taylor, for example, Black media talked more about Breonna Taylor than mainstream media talked about George Floyd. Mm-hmm. And George Floyd was the topic under kind of a racism umbrella that mainstream media talked about the most. Black media talked about health and comorbidity and all of these factors that impact Black people uniquely. And so Black media was really also important in getting the word out about the vaccine and talking about, talking to the concerns that the community had, taking it back to the historical context of the Tuskegee experiment, of medical experimentation, and saying, I understand your concerns. Here's some information to help you make a choice on what you want to do. And so Black media plays a critical role because they understand the community concerns, they understand the historical context, and the community can trust them because they know they're only trying to help and lift up the community. They've really been effective historically and currently in sharing information and getting the word out and keeping mm-hmm. our communities informed.
As we talk about the history and future of Black media, turning to Cheryl Thompson Morton there at the Black Media Initiative. We also have Michelle Bryant at WNOV in Milwaukee, Thomas Mitchell Jr. at the Milwaukee Community Journal. Join in, questions and comments, 800-642-1234. Kevin in Madison is here. Kevin, hi.
Hi there. Yeah, this is actually, I wanted to say hi to Thomas Mitchell and to Michelle Bryant. This is Kevin J. Walker. I used to deal with you all, talk with you all quite a bit. And I wanted to know about, for Thomas Mitchell, I wanted to know if he could briefly talk about the state of the NNPA, the National Newspapers Publishers Association. When I was managing editor at the Community Journal, it had over 450 newspapers. Some of those newspapers have gone down in number. I want to know what the national status of the NNPA is. And from Michelle Bryant, there are a lot of negative incidents that happened in Milwaukee that even make it here to Madison. I want to know about the caller response, because a lot of times the callers will call in and they will drive a conversation, because you being on the radio, you're immediate, you're right there. So something will happen on a Thursday and people respond to it on a Friday.
Kevin, appreciate you so much for calling in. Turning to Thomas Mitchell Jr. first, go ahead.
Well, Kevin, it's good to hear from you. Long time since we've talked. As far as the state of the NNPA, which is the National Newspaper Publishers Association, which is the trade association that represents, I believe, about 200, maybe a little bit more, Black newspapers around the country. It's a lot better than it was a few years ago. And you have to give credit to its executive director, Ben Chavis, who has kept or driven the organization to be more in tune with what's happening as it relates to getting news and how we report news now, especially in this digital age. He has a website. It sends us news and information that then we pass on to the community, national news and some international. They also have a pretty good digital presence. They've gone to video. They have a number of journalists doing videos or podcasts about issues that impact Black America. So it's an organization that is, I think, again, the last few years has done a good job of staying relevant and current.
Let's pause right there. Thomas Mitchell, Jr., editor of a Black newspaper covering the Milwaukee area. We have Michelle Bryant hosting a politics and current affairs talk show on WNOV, a Black-owned Milwaukee radio station. And Cheryl Thompson-Morton heads up the Black Media Initiative at City University of New York. Call in with a question at Thoughts, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Pew Research Center, it polls Black Americans about the media. Nearly two-thirds of respondents see issues with the way Black people are covered in the news. Call in with a question, share comments, 800-642-1234. Thomas Mitchell, Jr. is editor of the Milwaukee Community Journal. That's a Black newspaper serving the Milwaukee area. Michelle Bryant is here, public affairs talk show host for a Black-owned radio station in Milwaukee. And Cheryl Thompson-Morton is director of the Black Media Initiative at City University of New York. Cheryl, the murder of George Floyd by the hands of a Minneapolis police officer in 2020, it renewed widespread attention on the mistreatment of Black people by the criminal justice system. You mentioned Breonna Taylor shot and killed by police officers in 2020 as well. What issues affecting Black people in this country remain unacknowledged or ignored in the press?
Yeah, I mean, I think when we look at mainstream media, we often see Black folks are often overrepresented in negative lights. In crime coverage, for example, there's research that shows that Black people are overrepresented in instances of the news related to criminality. And we already know Black folks are overrepresented in the arrest pool.
Criminal justice system,
Yes, in the criminal justice system. So it just adds to a distortion of how Black folks are viewed. I even talked to a group who is creating an algorithm to look through different news outlets and be able to look at news outlet stories at scale and pull out trends and themes. And they saw that in using their data, they were pulling out the term Blacks for certain stories that they were like, I don't understand why this is coming up. But because the news historically has related, used the term Black or African American in things about crime, about racism, about poverty, whenever there was a story about those topics, even if it wasn't specifically about Black people, that term would come up. But when we saw other things that Black media actually talks quite a lot about, like education or politics or history, the Black label would not come, even if we were specifically talking about African Americans in those instances. And so it's a clear sign that both historically and presently, the way that Black communities are covered really focuses on a deficit framing of what's wrong, as opposed to an asset frame of what's going right in the community and how the community can be lifted up. And it misses the context of historic discrimination and racism that has led to the current context as well.
Hmm. Michelle, how do you address police violence on your show?
Well, you know, I think, quite frankly, similar to the lens in which a lot of Black media outlets talk about it, you know, people are always suspicious. And, you know, we try to provide balance. Here in Milwaukee, we have an African-American chief of police. We have an African-American Milwaukee County sheriff. And, you know, so talking to people, because we understand that there are people that look like you that are in law enforcement. And the one thing that, like, without fail, you will always hear callers to the show say, we know that not all officers are bad, but being able to, A, help people keep their objectivity, but to also understand how to voice concerns in a way that is constructive and produces the change that they want to see in these departments. So that's the thing that we always, Joe Madison, a notable talk show host who recently passed away, had a major show on Sirius XM. He would always end his comments by saying, so what are you going to do about it? You know, and that kind of drives me. We can't just be upset about what's happened. How do we change it? And that's the lens by which I try to give people something to do with that energy and to be able to have a outcome that in the midst of all of the negativity and the hurt and the trauma, you can still find something positive. How do we make sure this doesn't happen to someone else? How do you become a part of the Fire and Police Commission? You know, help us to recruit more officers of color. What can we do? So that's the lens by which I try to tackle these issues.
How do callers respond in those moments when you are trying to strike a balance? And that's really difficult.
Well, I'm fortunate. One of the things that I've heard Cheryl say, and I know Thomas will echo it, is trust is a huge factor. I am very fortunate that a lot of the listeners to my show actually trust me. And so, and I understand if I'm on 10, the listeners are on 10. And so, you know, I know what kind of what balance I want to strike before I bring the subject matter up. And there will be people that, and then let me just say this too. I'm also a Black person. I have a Black son. You know, I feel impacted the same way the community does about George Floyd. So even I have to think about like where I want to land as I talk about it, because sometimes I'm more animated than the audience. You know, like, I'm like, okay, Michelle, you're doing too much. I am much more, you know, outraged than the community can be sometimes about issues. So it is a give and take about trying to, again, strike that balance. But I go with the flow. You know, the caller who had called in and said, you know, what do you do about topics in real time? I've had my whole show blown up because something will happen and the community is upset and they want to talk, and I let them talk. And I tell people my only ground rule is that we're just not disrespectful, but whatever you need to say, and we don't call screen. So people have a lot of free rein to get it off their chest and express themselves.
Michelle Bryant at WNOV in Milwaukee. Thomas Mitchell Jr. is here at the Milwaukee Community Journal, and Cheryl Thompson Morton at the Black Media Initiative, as we talk about the history and future of Black media and take your calls. Call in with a question, comments, 800-642-1234. Jonathan is here in La Crosse. Jonathan, hi.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I used to work for the Community Journal back in the mid-70s. With Bob and Pat Thomas, Nathan Conyers, Michael Holt, and Harry Kemp. So it's wonderful to hear all of you today. I'm really curious, does the newspaper still have a pipeline for bringing aspiring journalism students into the newspaper? And I'm also curious about the great collection from Harry Kemp, the photographer for the Community Journal. He was around for many years. Was there any plans or have there been any books published with his photographs? Thank you for taking my call. Love hearing all of you.
Oh, Jonathan, we love hearing from you. Thank you. Thomas, go ahead.
There are no plans right now as far as any photos from photo display for Harry Kemp. His sister, who also shoots photos for us and for several years now, Yvonne Kemp, is the owner of all those photos, and she doesn't have any plans that I know of right now.
Can you explain what is so notable about the Kemp collection?
Harry Kemp was the Gordon Parks of Black Milwaukee. Mm-hmm. He shot photos for all three publications, you know, he was just a great photographer, a great storyteller with his photos. And people, you know, always would ask, can you send Harry to cover this or cover that? And more often than not, he'll make it either by bus or by car or hitch a ride. Sometimes I'll get take him to an assignment or pick him up from one, and then he would go. We would go to the office, and we would look at the photos, and we would talk about what's going on in the community, the politics, and other aspects that impact Black people in Milwaukee. He was a great reservoir of information and knowledge and history. Miss him today. And his sister has done a great job of taking his place and providing the images that show the positivity of being Black in Milwaukee.
What is the pipeline like for young Black journalists in Milwaukee?
We wish we could do more. I mean, I'll just be honest with you. I've had interns, young people who are interested in getting into the business. We had a young lady by the name of Princess Byers, who Marquette graduate. She now works for the Neighborhood News Service. I wish she was working for us, but, didn't work out the way I had hoped. We try to encourage and have individuals who are interested in learning about the business, and we try to work with them as best we can, given some of the constraints that we have as a newspaper. But we probably try to learn as much from them as we teach them.
Hmm.
They show us about the whole digital frontier that's out here. What we need to do as a newspaper in order to keep up with them. I ask them all the time, what is it that you want to read or in the newspaper that will, draw in a younger demographic? And some tell me that basically news that, impacts the community and impacts them from a more humanistic and personal perspective. So,
mm-hmm.
I have worked with the Journal Sentinel and their internship program. They will have a person who's interested come and work with us for several weeks at the newspaper. So we try to stay, in touch with the younger generation and try to encourage them to take the reins of in the Black press and keep this thing going.
I want to ask Cheryl about taking the reins and keeping it going and that younger generation, as you talk with publications around the country, what does that transition look like?
Yes, it's a great question. I mean, I think for a lot of news organizations, this is not unique to Black media. There is a challenge of succession and what happens when, people who have been putting their work into an organization for a long time, when they're ready to retire or move on, making sure that there's another generation behind to keep up the mantle. And so we're seeing, challenges with that, but we're also seeing solutions. I mean, many of the Black newspapers, some of the biggest ones throughout the country, have been family run for several generations, and younger generations are coming and taking on the reins. We also have a crop of new media organizations that are coming up from millennials, from Gen Z, doing amazing work in the digital space. I think the spirit of Black media really appeals to all generations of Black folks because we know the need. And so we, in our directory, we have both newspapers, radio stations, but also digital outlets who are producing original journalism. And it's a really robust group of young people all the way up doing this work.
Cheryl Thompson-Morton there leads the Black Media Initiative at City University of New York. Thomas Mitchell Jr., editor of the Milwaukee Community Journal, and Michelle Bryant hosts a politics and current affairs show on a Black-owned Milwaukee radio station. Call in with a question, add comments along the way, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Black Americans tend to be underrepresented in newsrooms nationwide. That's according to Pew Research Center. And we discuss the role of the Black press and its future in Wisconsin's media landscape. Call in with a question. Bring your perspective. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Our panel includes Cheryl Thompson-Morton, director of the Black Media Initiative at City University of New York. Thomas Mitchell Jr. is here, editor of the Milwaukee Community Journal. And Michelle Bryant, host of a current affairs show on a Black-owned Milwaukee radio station. Let's go to Kay in Madison now. Kay, hi. Go ahead.
Yeah, so good morning, and thank you for this show. I'm a Civil War historian, and I concentrate especially on women's military history. And basically, white and Black women are essentially blackballed from military history, especially as spies, et cetera. So one stunning example is a freed Black woman from Norfolk who provided personally to the Secretary of the Navy, Gideon Welles, information about the Merrimack being renovated, the famous Confederate ironclad being across the street from her and her husband's tavern in Norfolk. And based on the fact she told him that food was being loaded, the captain of the USS Monitor left early for the battle at Hampton's Road. And so Mary Lou Vest helped change world naval history. It was the first battle between two ironclads, and the Europeans basically had nothing to match this.
And so you're looking as to how could the Black press get the word out about these unknown historical figures, especially women. Cheryl, any insights there?
Yeah, I mean, you know, Black media loves stories like this, and they love being able to share little known facts about history. I often say in our research, we show the word history is uniquely prevalent in Black media in comparison to mainstream media. So often I think, you know, sharing these stories with folks in Black media and making sure that they're aware, they will be more than happy to share these stories, because this is a key part of what Black media does. This connects history to the present moment.
Michelle, what comes up for you in terms of connecting history to now and really sharing stories?
So on two fronts, I actually am an African-American history major. So it comes natural for me to weave historical facts, and I go on treasure hunts looking for information that I've never had. Ironically, because of my time slot, I have a lot of children that listen to the show on their way to school, in the car with parents. And so I'm always looking for things to give them as well from a historical perspective, but I'm blown away by the number of adults who said, you know, I never knew that. I never knew that there was an all Black female regiment during World War II, the Women's Army Corps. And, you know, so I talk about, yes, they just got a Congressional Gold Medal. And so I figure out ways to work that in, because the one thing, you know, and we see that in the current battle right now down in Florida with the effort to remove elements of Black history from public education, to censor what is said. So many people in our community don't know our full history. That has not been documented well. It's not been taught in classrooms. I know a lot because that was my focus in college. But, you know, that's the one thing for me. I always say we don't realize how great we are as a people, how great our contributions are. So if we don't know, the rest of the world really doesn't know either, because usually you tell your own stories. So those are some of the things that I do just automatically to try to make sure that we learn as much as we can about ourselves.
Kay, thank you for calling in. Thomas, I want to turn to you on a different topic, and that is budget and keeping the paper going. Can you talk about funding and how that work is in order to try to fund the news that you really want to cover?
That's one of the challenges of Black media in general, regardless if it's radio, print, online, or television. Roland Martin, who's a well-known Black journalist who has a podcast on YouTube and his own network, talks about the challenges he faces in getting corporations and other businesses like Coca-Cola or PepsiCo or some entity like that, or McDonald's, to advertise on his network and in Black press in general. It's always been a challenge. I think that there's hesitation by white businesses, because they think that we present too much drama, that we're a problem type of publication, always challenges authority and even businesses, and so they stay away and think that would be a turnoff to those who use their product. But that's just an excuse. They just don't want us to grow and to expand our coverage of issues that impact the Black community and thus impact America or Milwaukee or Wisconsin. So it is a challenge. We're ad-based as far as our revenue with advertising, and we find the challenges all the time. It's always been a challenge. As long as I've been at the community journal, it's been a challenge to get advertisers to advertise. For a while, because of George Floyd and this emphasis on DEI, was a little easier. But everybody has withdrawn now that some years have passed. And
you feel like it's now back to where you were in terms of support.
Oh, yeah. You see these companies take retreat on DEI. And even during the Floyd situation, that the advertising really didn't increase much for Black media. And this is really a problem even with political ads, trying to get them to spend money with the Black press in order to get the message out about their candidate. Businesses and even some organizations want you to have put their press release in, but they don't want to advertise. So we have to struggle with, do we put the press release in or leave it out because they don't they don't advertise? Because sometimes the information that they have is something that would be of use to the community.
Well, I want to thank you all for such a thoughtful conversation. Thank you for being here.
You're welcome. Thank you for having us.
Thank you, Kate.
Thank you so much.
That is Cheryl Thompson-Morton, director of the Black Media Initiative, Thomas Mitchell Jr., editor of the Milwaukee Community Journal, and Michelle Bryant, host of Say Something Real on WNOV. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.